This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
Tired of the everyday grind.
Night transmissions. Hi, this is Gary Clinton. I'm glad you made it. What we're going to be doing here tonight is delving into old radio shows. Tonight, first up, we're going to make a return visit to Great Britain and the show Price of Fear. The Price of Fear ran in the 1970s. I've not really been able to find specific dates. It appears that the shows ran sometime between 1973 and 1975. There were only about 20 of them. This particular show is called The Ninth Removal.
The Price of Fear, brought to you by Vincent Price.
Ever wonder what life will be like in, say, 50 years' time? I know I do, especially when I find myself becoming annoyed at some piece of modern tomfoolery. I suppose we all have little likes and dislikes connected with various aspects of modern living, but most of us forget them after a brief flash of annoyance. That is, until the next time. The point I'm making is that we don't dwell upon them continually and become obsessed by them, for that way lies madness. Take, for example, this strange tale, which I've called The Ninth Removal. It concerns the case of Amelia Sidgwick.
These modern young girls, their clothes are an outrage. Shorts, skirts, low-cut blouses, lipstick, disgusting.
My first, and thank goodness, my only encounter with Miss Sidgwick occurred when I called to see an old friend of mine, Peter Jarvis, in connection with some research I was doing for a film script I hoped to write. Peter was the head of a psychiatric clinic, and as I needed some background material on psychiatry, I had arranged to call on him one day at his office. I had expected a cold, cheerless, institutional building, but when I arrived, I was pleasantly surprised to find that the clinic was more like a well-appointed country house. I was greeted by a pretty receptionist, told to make myself comfortable, and that my friend Peter Jarvis would be available in a few minutes. Accordingly, I settled back in an armchair and picked up a magazine. Suddenly, I became aware of someone hovering over me.
Good afternoon. Are you being attended to?
Yes, I am. Thank you. I'm waiting to see Dr. Jarvis.
Oh, that's all right, then.
She was a tall, thin, scrawny woman of about 55 or so, dressed in a severely cut suit of dark gray material. She had a thin, white face with pinched lips and the most penetrating bright blue eyes that I have ever seen. Perhaps we would never have exchanged another word, but at that moment, I happened to turn over the page of my magazine, and in doing so, revealed a full-page advertisement, which showed a pretty, if overdeveloped, young lady wearing an incredibly low-cut dress.
Disgusting.
I beg your pardon?
That girl. Completely shameless. Just look at her.
The picture of the girl in the magazine seemed to have opened up a kind of mental floodgate. I just sat there, transfixed, and listened.
Of course, you know, the men are every bit as bad. They encourage that sort of thing. Why, only the other day, I was traveling home in the underground when... God, how I hate the underground, crushed together in this awful atmosphere. I sometimes think that hell isn't a matter of fire and brimstone at all, but simply traveling forever on the underground, surrounded by awful people. Those men sitting there so smug and oily looking. Not one of them would dream of offering me his seat. Pigs, that's what they are. Pigs. sitting there reading their newspapers. And what newspapers? Full of salacious muck. Headline there. Another sex murder victim found on common. Is it any wonder the way these modern girls dress? That one over there, crossing and uncrossing her legs. Oh, and that short skirt. Disgusting. Oh, she's smiling. Oh, yes, she's noticed that young man ogling her. I'd teach her. I'd take a whip to her. My dear father would never have allowed me to carry on like that. Dear father.
The devil's army is all around us, my child. Never forget it. You must fight it. Fight it with all your might. Never cease to fight for God.
I have fought, Father. Oh, how I've fought for your stern God. Will this journey ever end?
I sat there fascinated as Miss Sidgwick rambled on and on. At times she spoke clearly and precisely. At others she was almost incoherent with rage. Having at length described to me the trials and tribulations which she had suffered on the London underground system, she then went on to tell me about her work. Miss Sidgwick's employers had, it seems, been many and various. Her typing plus her sense of duty were beyond reproach. Employers might appreciate her work, but it seems to a man they were lovers of peace, taking unkindly to criticism, and at length Miss Sidgwick was cast out, and with each casting out, her hate grew. One day, however, she joined a company run by a retired brigadier who had inherited his father's tea importing business. The atmosphere was middle-aged, quiet, and respectable, and the office staff adhered to the old ways of dress and deportment. They also had a great advantage, as far as Miss Sidgwick was concerned, of being easily cowed, and she soon came to rule the roost. As for the brigadier himself...
You see, the brigadier was a tall, distinguished, gray-haired gentleman, with both good looks and charming manners. He was not married, he did not smoke, and he was always extremely respectful towards his female employees. He was what I should call a gentleman of the old school.
From her manner, I guessed that Miss Sidgwick was not in love with the brigadier. It was just that she worshipped him. And then one morning...
Miss Sidgwick?
Yes, sir?
Will you come in a moment, please?
Certainly, sir.
That's right, dear lady. Just come in and shut the door, will you? That's a ticket. Now, just take a seat. Mm-hmm. I have something to say to you. Now, the point is that I've decided to expand our little team.
Indeed, sir.
Yes, in fact, I've engaged a young lady. Excellent character. She's to join us on Monday.
I see, sir.
Needless to say, dear lady, I will look to you to see that Miss Franklin... That's her name, by the way. That she settles in happily. I know that I can trust you to keep an eye on her and so forth.
I shall do my duty, sir, as always.
Of course you will, dear lady. That goes without saying.
The following Monday morning began very badly for Miss Sidgwick. On the underground, a large man stood on her toe. He was rewarded by a sharp kick on the shins. But there was worse to come. When she arrived at the office, she found her fellow workers in a buzz of curious excitement as they awaited the arrival of the new girl.
Good morning.
Miss, can I help you?
I hope so. I'm Anne Franklin. I'm going to work here.
I see.
Ooh, look at that. It's going to be a pleasure showing her the ropes.
Mr. Parsons, I suggest that you get on with your work. After all, you are being paid to do it. Miss Franklin, may I ask if that is your normal business attire?
Oh, the gear. Well, it's all I've got. I mean, I've got lots of clothes, but they're all like this. It's all right, isn't it? My last place didn't mind.
This is a respectable office.
I should hope so. Otherwise, I shouldn't have come to work here.
Ah, Miss Franklin, so you've arrived.
Good morning, sir.
My word. How fresh and smart you look. Like a breath of spring, eh, Miss Sidgwick?
If you say so, sir.
Yes, I do, dear lady. And now I'll leave Miss Franklin in your capable hands.
Yes, sir.
During the next few days, Miss Sidgwick could be likened to a lion in a cage with a succulent but stupid lamb which the laws of creation had, for some reason, forbidden it to eat.
Oh, that stupid girl, flaunting herself, smiling at every man who comes within range. She even took to applying her lipstick during working hours. To this day, I do not know how I managed to restrain myself.
All these things might just have been bearable if it had not been for the girl's work. It was awful.
There we are. How's that, then?
No. This will not do, I'm afraid. There are 6 mistakes in this one letter alone.
Oh, dear, you are fussy.
And here, look, 3 misspellings and last year's date. I'm sorry, but this will also have to be done again.
God, I've certainly made a hell of a bloody mess of that one.
What did you say?
Well, I mean, I've made a mess of it, haven't I?
Let it be understood, Miss Franklin, that foul language is not tolerated in this office. Neither is blasphemy. Do I make myself clear?
Yes, miss. Oh, I'm sorry, but you are a funny old stick.
What?
Nothing is a fruitcake.
This has gone quite far enough. I am going to see the Brigadier.
And so Miss Sidgwick stormed into the Brigadier's office and there presented him with the full catalogue of her complaints against the pretty young newcomer. His reaction, however, was not quite what she had expected.
Alas, the youth of today, Miss Sidgwick, does not adhere to the principles we treasure.
But you do not see, son. Blinded by your own goodness, you do not see. She bears her flesh, she paints her face, she encourages men. Why, Mr. Parsons has hardly been himself since she came here. In addition to which, she cannot type.
I, too, Miss Sidgwick, deplore the lax morals and lower standards of this permissive age. But, dear lady, you and I can't fight the world.
Oh, correct me, sir, if I am wrong, but surely a soldier who believes in his cause never ceases to fight.
True, very true. But when defeat is certain, he changes his tactics. He pretends to surrender, infiltrates the enemy's ranks, and becomes an underground force.
Oh, but that she insulted me. She should be cast out.
That, dear lady, would be to admit defeat. I'll tell you what. Ask her to come and see me, will you?
You will chastise her, sir.
Appealing as the prospect is, dear lady, I fear that I shall have to content myself with a reprimand on this occasion. Thank you for bringing the matter to my attention.
Thank you, sir.
And Mr. Dwick?
Yes, sir.
You are my strong right arm. Never forget that.
Oh, sir.
And remember, infiltrate the enemy's ranks, dear lady. Infiltrate the enemy's ranks.
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed, sir. I'll remember.
For the rest of that day, Miss Sidgwick, it seems, basked in a golden haze, remembering the Brigadier's words.
You are my strong right arm, dear lady.
Oh, I am. I am.
She was even seen to smile when Miss Franklin came to apologize.
Miss, I've come to say I'm sorry, Miss, and I want to apologize for my rudeness this morning.
You've evidently seen the Brigadier.
Yes, Miss. And he pointed out that I was wrong to talk to you in that way, Miss. It won't happen again, Miss. I promise.
I should hope not. Now, girl, go back to your work and concentrate, girl. Concentrate.
By tea time that day, Miss Sidgwick had even unbent sufficiently to spend a few moments chatting with Mr. Parsons and Miss Franklin about the latest topics of interest.
Oh, no, Mr. Parsons. I don't think that sort of thing could ever happen here. We breed a much better type of politician. So much more background.
Listen to this in the paper. Another of those sex murders. A girl of 19 found brutally murdered on Wimbledon Common. This is the 8th victim to be struck down in the past 2 years. Gives me the creep. Whoever does it must be kinky.
Poor girl. I wonder why so many of these attacks take place nowadays.
Well, I can tell you. Because these modern girls ask for it. Short skirts, lipstick, low-cut trousers. Is it any wonder they get assaulted?
Assaulted, I can understand. Murdered. Ugh.
Miss Sidgwick was about to launch herself upon a lengthy and angry tirade concerning Miss Franklin and all girls like her when she remembered the Brigadier's words.
Infiltrate the enemy's ranks, dear lady.
Isn't it strange how great disasters often have humble beginnings? A smoldering cigarette end tossed carelessly aside, and an entire building burns down. Or a cat runs across a busy street, a bus swerves, and someone is killed. Well, that night on her way home, Miss Sidgwick suddenly realized that she had forgotten her umbrella. Now, Miss Sidgwick without her umbrella was like a D'Artagnan without his sword. Her umbrella, apart from its proper use, was also invaluable on occasions for shin-cracking or rib-poking. And so, muttering angrily to herself, she retraced her steps to the now deserted office. But was it deserted?
That's strange. A light in the brigadier's office. But I wonder, can he be working? He didn't say anything. No, no, silly of me. Perhaps he just forgot to turn off the ignition. What's that? Oh, dear. Perhaps I'd better investigate. Whoever it is has left the brigadier's door open. I wonder if I can see. Charles, this is cozy. Just the two of us.
Just the two of us. Kiss me again, Anne.
Greedy.
Miss Sidgwick stood there and stared in horror. The brigadier and Miss Franklin were far too occupied to notice the white face staring at them through the open doorway. To say that Miss Sidgwick was in a state of shock would be to put it mildly. She left the building quickly and began to walk.
I walked a long way that night, through Panton Street into Leicester Square, back again into Piccadilly, through the seedy streets of Soho, and everywhere the voice of corruption screamed at me from hoardings, bookshop windows, cinema posters, from the white leering faces of men and the painted faces of the women. I heard the laughter of the men and the women, the noise of the traffic passing by. I cried out, why am I forsaken? Then an awful thought came to me. Could it possibly be that I was mad? Hurriedly, I pushed the thought to the back of my mind. Then I imagined I saw rows and rows and rows of faces, laughing, leering, grinning faces. I wanted to smash them!
The next morning, I gather, saw Miss Sidgwick back at her desk, as usual. She rebuked Miss Franklin for her bad typing and greeted the brigadier with reserve. From that time on, she watched both of them, much as a stoat watches a pair of well-fed rabbits, keeping meticulous note of their movements. Each day, she carefully examined the brigadier's desk diary. At last, her vigilance was rewarded. She discovered in the diary an entry for the following Wednesday evening. The brigadier had written AF, followed by an exclamation mark. The question was, where would they meet? Miss Sidgwick decided to make certain. On that Wednesday evening, she followed Miss Franklin almost to her front door. Then she hid in the shadows and prepared to wait. To wait, if necessary, for hours. In fact, her vigil lasted barely half an hour. Then Miss Franklin came out of the house and began to walk towards the nearby underground station. Miss Sidgwick followed.
I remember she was hurrying, but it was quite easy, really, to keep up with her. I followed her along the passage and along the tunnel that led to the ticket office. I can see her now. She was wearing a blue two-piece costume with an incredibly short skirt. She wore high-heeled shoes, and she carried a white handbag, which she swung as she walked along. And on the escalator, a number of men turned to stare at her as she passed. When she reached the platform, she almost stood at the edge, doing a little impatient jigging dance as she waited for the train to arrive. The platform was fairly crowded, and I was able to get so close to her that I could smell the cheap perfume she'd obviously drenched herself with. As we waited for the train to arrive, the platform became more and more crowded. I moved closer to her. I began to feel strange, warm excitement. Then, as the train drew nearer and nearer, I leaned forward. You little slut! You have corrupted God! At the same time, I pushed her hard. Nobody saw me do it. The platform was too crowded. Then I stepped back and was immediately lost in the crowd as it surged forward. I left the station, made my way back to the office where I knew the Brigadier would be waiting. Waiting for her.
So here you are at last. Miss Sidgwick. What are you doing here? Is something wrong?
No.
I'm sorry, I don't understand. Is there something you want to tell me?
Yes, sir. Yes, yes.
I see. Sit down, won't you? No? Well, I'm afraid whatever it is, we'll just have to wait until morning. I have an important engagement tonight.
No, sir. You have no engagement. Miss Franklin, that slut, will not be coming here tonight.
What the devil do you mean?
I saw you, both of you, that night. And since then, I've watched and waited. Then tonight, I struck.
I see. Miss Sidgwick, I think perhaps you'd better sit down. But first, I suggest that you put down that obviously lethal weapon you've been trying to conceal beneath your coat.
Oh, but
I... Please do as I say, at once. I'm not accustomed to having my orders disobeyed. Thank you. A dangerous-looking knife, dear lady. Where did you get it?
I bought it at the ironmonger's. Nobody knows I've got it. Nobody saw me.
I take it that you did not use it on poor Miss Franklin.
No. I pushed her under a train.
Oh. Did anybody see you?
No. Well, that is, I don't think so. It would look like an accident.
Well, I suppose you must be thankful for that. Miss Sidgwick, I'm very displeased with you. Did I not say to you in this very office not so long ago that you were to infiltrate the enemy's ranks, act as they do?
Yes, sir, but...
I'm not interested in your excuses. I only want to know why you took it upon yourself to make what I can only describe as managerial decisions. I am the general in this army, Miss Sidgwick, and I alone make the decisions. I decide who is to be removed. Do I make myself clear?
I'm so sorry. I don't understand.
Being sorry would not have been much comfort if you had brought disaster on my entire campaign by your thoughtless and ill-conceived actions, dear lady. I have great plans for you. Great plans. In time, I might well have allowed you to work in the field with me. Oh. But now, how can I ever trust you again?
Oh, please, please trust me. Oh, please.
It's been a glorious campaign so far. 8 of them I've removed. The last one on Wimbledon Common. And the fame of my work has been proclaimed throughout the country. Front page stuff, too. They came to me, flaunting their bodies. Young, eager. For a while, I became as they were. Then I struck. I took them to lonely places. And then... And you, Miss Chidwick, have interfered. You have destroyed the ninth removal.
Oh, I'm so very sorry, you said. I didn't know. Please, please forgive me. Oh, please.
I do forgive you, dear lady. For I see now that you only acted with the very best intentions.
Oh.
Yes, I forgive you. We have a great task before us, you and I. For you see, dear lady, there are so many... So very many more to be removed.
I sat there in that comfortable, warm waiting room, listening to Miss Sidgwick pouring out her dreadful, monstrous, unbelievable story. I sat there stunned, not daring to look her in the face. Then, suddenly, I was roused from my daze by the arrival of my friend, Dr. Jarvis.
Hello, Vincent.
Oh, hello, Peter.
So sorry to have kept you all this time. I got held up in a difficult case. Hello, Miss Sidgwick. You here?
Yes, sir. I'm just going. I only looked in to see that everything was as it should be. Well, goodbye. It's been so nice to have someone to talk to.
Well, goodbye.
Bye-bye, dear lady.
Peter, that woman, is she... safe. I mean...
Miss Sidgwick.
Yes.
Satan's houses. Interesting case, though. I must tell you about it sometime.
Yes. Yes, you must.
I say, you all right, old man? I say, you do look a bit seedy. Fancy you getting stuck with old Mark Sidgwick.
Excuse me, Dr. Jarvis.
We were suddenly interrupted by the arrival of a very pretty young blonde. As she came towards us, I experienced, for a moment, a strange sense of unreality. For I saw that she was wearing a blue two-piece suit with an incredibly short skirt. She was carrying a white handbag and wore high-heeled shoes.
Sorry to disturb you.
Yes?
I've left the papers for the Peabody case on your desk, but I wondered what you wanted to do about these two, Fredericks and Wilkinson. You did say they were urgent.
Good Lord, I did. I've forgotten all about them. Thank you for reminding me. I'm not going to have any time today. I'll tell you what. If it's all right with you, why don't we stay on late this evening? Get them cleared away. Who knows? If we get finished quickly, I might even reward you by taking you out to supper. I know a nice little restaurant out near Wimbledon Common.
That would be nice. Thank you.
Right, Miss Davis. Let's settle then. Well, come along, old man. You can't stay here ogling our Miss Davis all day. I'll have some coffee sent into my office. We can talk in peace there. Come on. We've got work to do.
And work we did. Peter proved a mine of information concerning psychiatry. I listened to him carefully and made copious notes. But somehow, after that visit, I didn't feel that I had the heart to carry on with my film script. I felt, to put it mildly, out of my depth. And so, having thought about the whole thing carefully, I decided that all things considered, it might be better if I stuck to something simple. It might, I thought, be safer to write a cookery book, for example, and that's exactly what I did.
That was Vincent Price bringing you The Price of Fear. Also starring in The Ninth Removal were Frieda Jackson and Richard Pearson, with Claire Sutcliffe, Michael Siegel, and Alan Rowe. The Ninth Removal was first recounted by R. Chetwynd Hayes, dramatized by Barry Campbell, and produced by John Dyer.
This is the second episode of The Price of Fear that I've done on this show. The first one was a few weeks back and was called Blind Man's Bluff. It was a pretty neat show, too. Macabre, our second show tonight, has a somewhat checkered history. Originally, it was an American series that aired in the 1940s and 50s. In late 1961, the American Armed Forces Radio Service produced 8 more. This is the first of those. Then, subsequent to that, the BBC launched a series that aired in 1966 through 1974. This is the first of the 8 shows produced by Armed Forces Radio, Final Resting Place. It aired on November the 13th, 1961.
Man lives in a world of time and space. He lives in a spectrum of the universe. When he ventures beyond this limit, he is in the unknown, a realm where strange forces are brought into play. When man attempts to misuse these forces, he is sometimes destroyed. This is Macabre. The Far East Network presents, in special performance, Macabre. Tonight's story, Final Resting Place.
Richard, this doesn't look like the road. Honey, I think we're lost.
It has to be right, Sue. Just as the piece back at Carterville said the lake was on the main highway. We haven't made any turns.
But, darling, it's getting dark. This road doesn't look well-traveled. I really think we made a wrong turn somewhere.
Mrs. Kent, your husband solemnly promises to deliver his bride of a few hours safely and surely to Honeymoon Lodge on Mirror Lake. Now, let's hear no more about it. Come on, move closer. Head on my shoulder. That's it.
Roger, you better watch the road.
Why? We haven't passed another car for an hour. Relax, Sue. It's a fine way to start a married life of bliss.
Look, there's a sign. Can you make it out?
Yeah. Randolph, 5 miles.
Are we supposed to go this way?
Sure. What'd I tell you? It's only 50 miles farther. Randolph is our halfway point.
But this country road, how can they call a lonely trail like this a highway?
You're just a sophisticated cityite. Now close your eyes and listen to the radio. We'll be there before you know it.
All right, darling. I guess I'm getting jumpy.
Head on my shoulder and not another word. Okay?
Okay.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin. Authorities at the state asylum have just issued the following warning. A dangerous homicidal maniac escaped custody this morning and is believed to be in the vicinity of Randolph.
Roger!
He's 45 years of age, weighs 200 pounds, has thick gray hair, and answers to the name of Dr. Vardmore. We repeat, this man is a dangerous killer. Those in the vicinity of Randolph are urged to take extra precaution tonight. Since this killer is armed, the public is warned against walking alone or driving at night on the quiet roads near Randolph. Report all suspicious persons to the county sheriff's office. Now we return you to Stars of Music.
Roger, did you hear that?
Sure, but how does it concern us?
Darling, we are driving down a country road near Randolph. Suppose we should have a car trouble or a flat tire.
Boy, you are getting jumpy.
Let's stop in Randolph for the night.
But Sue, our reservations at Mirror Lake are for tonight.
Please, Roger. I have the strangest feeling. If we don't stop at Randolph, we'll never reach Mirror Lake.
Great idea, Sue.
What, darling?
Stopping here for the night? Now we can see the carnival.
It's all right while these people are here, I guess. But we'd better go back to the hotel before they leave.
Are you still afraid?
Well, kinda. Aren't you?
Come on. I'll show you a good time. You'll forget all about it.
Okay. What's that man doing over there?
And now, ladies and gentlemen, if you'll kindly step closer...
I don't know. Let's find
out. I will demonstrate for you one of the great marvels of all time. As you see at my feet is a hole, an excavation 6 feet in depth, a grave, if you will. And beside me here is a casket. Now, friends, what do you think we are going to do? Now, friends, ladies and gentlemen, have no fear. Tonight, I, Professor Vincent, will select someone, one of you from the audience, to be hypnotized and placed in this casket. Then I will bury him alive for 5 days.
If he's not buried that long, he ain't
going to
wind up much alive.
Just a moment, please. 5 days at $100 a day. Now, what do you say? Who wants to make $500? There is absolutely no danger. A shaft will be sunk so that we can see your head. You'll get plenty of light and air. Food will be lowered to you. Nothing to it at all. Who'll be the first volunteer?
You got as popular
an
undertaker, pal.
Come, come now, ladies and gentlemen. Under hypnosis, believe me, 5 days will seem like an hour. The easiest $500 you've ever made. Who will volunteer? How about you, my bumpkin comedian friend?
No, sir. Last year I took sick with pneumonia. Thought sure I'd end up in one of them boxes.
Did you recover? It's hard to tell from looking at you. You, sir. What is your name?
Roger, he's pointing at you.
I don't think I'd be interested.
Who are you, sir?
Roger Kent.
Roger Kent, does $500 interest you?
Well, sure, but...
Good. Good, you'll make a fine subject.
Now, wait a minute.
And Roger, who is the young lady with you?
My wife, Sue.
Oh? And what do you say, Mrs. Kent?
Why, I think it's just a dreadful idea. No.
You better pick someone else, Professor.
Nonsense. Do you need the money?
We do need it. But not this way, Roger. It's awful.
$500 would pay off the car. We still have 10 days left for our honeymoon, Sue.
Well, how about it, friends?
Don't let him tempt you. I don't like that man.
It is a lot of money for only 5 days.
We can't wait all night. What do you say?
I don't know.
Say no, Roger.
Speak up. Yes or no?
I hate to turn it down.
You're not going to be buried in that terrible coffin. Tell him no.
Go ahead, pal. We got a first-class cemetery.
All right. All right, everyone. Roger and Sue, time's up. Tell you what I'll do. Think it over. If you decide to go through with it, come back after a couple of hours when the carnival is closed for the night. I'll be waiting for you in my trailer.
Oh, Roger, he wants you. I'm afraid of that man.
Don't forget, I'll wait up for you. Until you decide one way or the other, Roger Kent will hold the grave open for you.
Listen, Sue, my mind's made up.
But suppose...
Face up to it. We need the money. That's the easiest $500 I ever heard of.
Darling, I know that.
Then what's the matter?
Well, in the first place, we shouldn't be out here in the dark with that madman loose. In the second place...
Professor Vincent seems too interested in me.
Oh, Roger, you read my mind. I'm just trying to protect you, honey. That man, I don't know that... Something wrong.
Admit it, Sue. You don't like the Buried Alive act. Isn't that it?
Yes, I guess so. It's horrible.
I thought so. Uh-oh. This must be his trailer. Professor Vincent. Here it is.
Roger.
Yeah?
If he answers, there'll be no turning back. It'll be too late.
I know. No turning back.
Professor Vincent?
Come in, Roger and Sue. Come in.
Did you really think we'd come?
I was certain. You see, there is no other way. When I count three, Roger, you will be asleep. Sound asleep on your feet. Then, Roger, you will be placed in the coffin. And lowered into the grave for your 5-day rest. Now look deeply into my eyes. Deeply. Inhale. And look deeply into my eyes. You're going to sleep, Roger. To sleep. You can no longer move your arms. They hang helpless at your side. Sleep, Roger. Close your eyes and sleep. One, two, your eyes are closed. And now you are powerless to open them. You are free. Asleep. Ladies and gentlemen, we are ready to place Roger Kent in the casket. Whom among you in the audience will help me?
I will, Professor.
All right, my friend. Step right up here now. Here, help me raise the lid of this coffin.
Now, give me his feet and we'll put him in.
Careful. He's a big man. There. He's in.
Gosh, heavy as a rock. Just like a dead man.
Yes, now, close the lid. Close it. Now we're ready to lower into the grave. You see, the casket is supported over the open hole by two chains. If you'll flip that switch the same time I flip this one, Mr. Kent will be gently deposited in his grave.
This one?
Yes. There it goes.
Glory be. Just like a real funeral. Reminds me of the time we buried my grandpappy.
Ladies and gentlemen, in just a few moments, the coffin will lie at the bottom of the grave. We will then place an air shaft down to Mr. Kent's head so that he'll be able to breathe. And all of you will be able to see him at 25 cents apiece.
I don't know. I just don't know.
Thank you, friend. You've done your work now. Will you kindly leave? Thank you. You are witnessing the marvel of the age. A human being buried alive. The casket has stopped. Will another volunteer from the audience help me position the air shaft?
How about me?
Fine. Step up here, friend, if you please.
You picked the right one this time, Governor.
So?
I used to work in a funeral parlor. Handle the stiffs.
Yes, now. Now, just pick up that end of the metal shaft, please. Easy does it now. Down over the round opening on the casket lid. Careful now. There. Thank you very much, my friend. Neat, very neat.
Okay, Governor. What next?
The shovel. The hole must be covered up.
Oh, sure.
And that is it, ladies and gentlemen. You have just seen demonstrated the marvel of the age. A man buried alive. Kent will lie there in a deep slumber. The end of which time we'll dig him up and pay him $500. In the meantime, my friends, you may step up here and view him down the shaft for a small sum of 25 cents. One quarter, the one-fourth part of a dollar. Ladies and gentlemen, who will be first among you?
No, sir.
What's that you say?
Dishonest, I say.
What's the matter with you?
Charging money to see him buried alive.
What?
I don't know. I helped you lift him in.
Leave the carnival, sir. Leave here immediately.
That man ain't buried alive. He's dead.
Hello?
Hello, Mrs. Kent. This is Professor Vincent. I got your message. First chance I've had to call you.
Oh, Professor, I'm so glad you did.
What's on your mind?
How is Roger?
I keep telling you he's all right. Now, you must stop this nonsense.
Well, it's been 3 days since he was buried, and he just lies there so still. Oh, if I could only talk to him.
Mrs. Kent.
I called down to him, but he never moves or opens his eyes. And after all this time, I know something is wrong. Roger wouldn't let me worry like this. He'd at least look up and smile, if he could.
How many times must I repeat he is hypnotized?
We interrupt this program for a special news bulletin.
Oh, just a moment, Professor. The radio...
Sheriff's office has just confirmed the whereabouts of the homicidal maniac who escaped from the state asylum 3 days ago. This dangerous killer who calls himself Dr. Vardmore is now known to be in the immediate vicinity of Randolph. Everyone is cautioned against walking alone on the streets after dark. If you plan to attend the carnival, kindly do so with friends and leave the carnival in the company of others. Report all suspicious persons. We return you now to your regular program.
Did you hear that on the radio?
Yes, I did.
Oh, Professor, I'm terribly afraid. I don't want Roger alone down there with this madman, Lou. Please, Professor, dig Roger up tonight.
Mrs. Kent, we made a bargain, a business proposition. Kindly stay in your hotel room and rest. This is the third day. The day after tomorrow, it will be all over for Roger and for you.
Pardon me, ma'am. Are you Mrs. Kim?
Why, yes. Who are you?
I'm the one who helped put your husband in the casket.
Well, why are you talking to me?
I don't know. Just to warn you, I guess. I think your husband's dead.
Oh, you horrible, horrible little man. Get away from me. I'll call the police.
That's you, Mrs. Kent.
Oh, Professor Vincent, I'm so glad to see you. A terrible little man.
Yes, I heard what he said. Now get hold of yourself and listen to me carefully. This is the fifth night. I want you to go to the hotel and wait until the carnival is over. Tonight is the last showing at Randolph. At 11:30, you take a taxi out here to the lot. I'll meet you. Roger will be ready along with the $500.
All right, Professor. Anything you say. Oh, thank God this is about to end.
Yes, my dear. It's all about to end.
Are you going out, Miss Kent?
Yes, clerk. And here's the key to my room.
Thank you. I don't think it's wise, though. I mean, you're going out alone. It's after 11 and mighty dark tonight.
The police haven't caught the killer yet?
No. Funny thing, too. Looks like he'll have to leave a fresh trail. You know, kill somebody so they'll have more to go on. Now, why don't you take someone with you?
Oh, I'll be all right. I'm meeting Professor Vincent at the carnival lot. This is the night they released my husband.
I see.
Do you know the professor?
Oh, yes, I do.
Well, he's the one who hypnotized Mr. Kent.
No. Professor Vincent didn't.
What?
Professor got sick 5 days ago.
Got sick? Well, then who was Professor Vincent at the carnival?
I don't know. Somebody who took his place, I guess.
Oh.
Here you are, driver. Thank you.
Professor Vincent, it's so dark. Where are you?
I'm sure the carnival was on this vacant lot, but now there's nothing. Just a few old papers blowing in the wind. Why did I let that cab leave? No light in sight. Those trees around the lot. What if the killer were hiding there? Oh, the place Roger was buried. It was in this direction. This way. Maybe I can find it. And Graham will be shot. Where they dug him up, they filled the hole. Must be right around here. Where is it? What's this? Mount!
No. They can't do that. They went away and left you buried. Oh, Roger. I'll get you out, honey. Oh, my darling, I'll help you. I'll dig a thing.
Something is watching me from those trees. I saw it move. I could get out of here. I'll be back, Roger. There's no night filling station 5 blocks away. Maybe I can make it there. Oh, it moved again. There is someone out there. Roger, is that you? No, it's coming after me. It's too big for Roger. I don't know what it is. It's gaining on me. I can't let it catch me. No!
Mrs. Kent, calm yourself, please.
Who are you?
Don't you know? I'm Professor Vincent. I was waiting for you. Now, come with me to my trailer.
No, you're not Professor Vincent.
So, you guessed.
Who are you?
There's nothing to be alarmed about. You're in safe hands at last. I am Victor. Dr. Victor Vardmore.
I've been asleep, I guess. Legs feel cramped. Mind's foggy. Can't remember what happened. Sue, where are you? Dark. Pitch black. Must be night. Quiet. Not a sound. I could only remember. Think back. Smells damp, like fresh earth. Where am I? Gotta get up and stretch my leg. No rooms. Wait a minute. There was this carnival. Professor Vincent. Oh, it's beginning to come back now. I was hypnotized and put in a casket. Buried for 5 days, yeah. Yeah, it's clear now. Time's up, yeah. They're gonna dig me up now. Boy. A deep hypnotic spell that old boy put me in. I'm glad it's over. Okay, Professor. You can bring me up now. I guess he stepped away from the shaft. Shaft? Where's the shaft? It's supposed to be over my head here so I can see up. Can't see a thing. Cloth-lined coffin lid where shaft should be. What's going on here? I'd like to get out, Professor. Possible they went away and left me buried alive? Oh, no. Professor! Sue! Help! I'm buried alive! Good Lord. Help! Gotta get out. Help me, somebody! Don't leave me down here to die! Help! Push harder! More! No use. No buts. I'm gonna die. You left me here to die. Can't call for help. Nobody to hear me. Carnival left. Nothing up there but a vacant lot, edge of town. If somebody came back, how could he tell I was down here buried? Oh, God, don't let this happen to me. Please. Help me. Save me, God.
don't let this. I don't want to die.
Roger.
I'm hearing things.
This is Professor Vincent. Now listen carefully.
Where are you? Get me out of here.
Don't fret. Your oxygen supply won't last much longer.
Oxygen?
You're buried alive, Roger. And I'm not coming back for you.
Not going back?
I'm leaving you buried there.
Well, Professor, I'll kill you.
Oh, Roger, tell me how.
I'll kill...
Don't excite yourself any further. The oxygen pellet won't sustain your lungs. You are hearing my voice in a small, shortwave receiver and transmitter near your head. I am talking to you from my trailer about a block from you. Sue is with me, Roger. I want you to listen very, very carefully.
Sue, there.
Go ahead, Sue. Tell him.
Oh, Roger, are you all right?
Yes. What's he doing with you?
Please do as he says, darling. He's not the real professor. He's that escaped madman from the asylum, Dr. Vardmore.
He's crazy, Sue.
Please, darling, we have no choice.
Please, quick.
Listen to me. One move like that, and I will kill you both. I've gone to a lot of trouble to set up my final demonstration.
What are you going to do?
I am going to try personality transference. We have the required situation. A man buried alive in mortal fear of death. And the woman he loves who will do anything to save him.
If we do, as you say, what then?
I will release the two of you.
And if we don't?
You have just enough oxygen for just a few more minutes.
I see.
Hurry, Dr. Vardmore. Get it over with.
Now, Roger, I want you to think about Sue. Sue, you about Roger. Each imagine he is the other. Roger, you are standing beside me in the trailer. Sue, you are lying down there in the casket.
No!
Cooperate and I will free you. It's your only way out of that grave.
If it works, you mean I'll be in Sue's?
Yes, and she in yours.
Do it, darling. It's our only chance.
He's not Sue.
That's enough. One more refusal, and I'll turn off the shortwave transmitter and leave you in your dark world forever. Now, Roger, imagine you are Sue standing here. Sue, you concentrate on being Roger in the casket. Think. Put everything else out of your minds. I have it. Repeat something you both know. Say the 23rd Psalm. Here we go now. Start with me. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures.
He leadeth me beside still waters. He restoreth my soul. He leadeth me in paths of righteousness. For his name's sake,
even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod
and thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table.
Roger! Sue! Help me! Don't leave me down here! The oxygen! It's coming! They're going to save me! They're going to take me up! I'm dying! No, I am!
Just heard Macabre, a special Far East Network presentation. In our cast were John Buey as Professor Vincent, Mitzi Hennessy as Sue, William Verdier as Roger, Milton Radmilovich, Air Force Sergeant Bob Eddy, and Air Force Sergeant Newell Stewart. Technical supervision by Hiroshi Odo. This is Air Force Sergeant Al LePage speaking. Macabre was written and directed by William Verdier. Macabre comes to you each week at this time through the worldwide facilities of the United States Armed Forces Radio and Television Service.
Well, okay, that was macabre. As I say, there aren't too many of those. I've got 8, and I'll do them from time to time. Coming up next is a show from the 1950s. Well, actually, I shouldn't say the 1950s. It ran from 1950 to 1952. Actually, only about a year and a half there, from March the 15th until January of 1952. The show was called 2000 Plus and was presented by the Mutual Network. The show tonight ran on September the 27th of 1950.
Adventures in the world of tomorrow. Dramatic stories of science fiction from the years beyond 2000 A.D. Today, the story of a horrible nightmare that wouldn't stop, even when the dreamer woke up. A story called The Green Thing. It is the year 2000 plus 175. It is late evening, and all is peaceful and quiet in Dr. Harvey Glendon's sanitarium. Outside, on a vast estate that stretches away from the main building, there are only the soft country noises, the wind sighing in the trees, the shrill chirpings of innumerable crickets. In the well-furnished rooms, the patients sleep, stretched out on comfortable mattresses and clean white sheets, the country breezes straying over their forms. In room 32B, Mr. Summers sleeps peacefully, with his head on a fluffy pillow. He sleeps, and he dreams.
Help me! Help me! Please!
So, in the light of the growing psychological problems facing our nation, the government has sent me to you, Dr. Glendon, to enlist your aid, since you're the country's outstanding psychiatrist.
Well, I'm honored indeed, Mr. Carley. But I don't know that there's much I can tell you about the advancement of psychiatric research that isn't being published in the medical journals.
Well, Dr. Glendon, isn't there anything that you're working on now, something definite? I know you're a cautious scholar, but...
Look, Mr. Carling, it isn't possible to announce sweeping new generalizations in our kind of science. Our work is painstaking, complex, highly subjective. You take the case of one of the patients here in the sanitarium. Oh, Betty... Will you bring our records of Mr. Summers?
Yes, Dr. Glendon, just one moment.
Summers is about 40, 41. He was admitted 5 months ago, suffering from a melancholia.
Here's the records, Doctor.
Oh, thanks, Terry. Now, as you can see from these notations, he's been feeling much better the past few weeks.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I see.
Until last night, when he suddenly woke up screaming in his bed. He was being attacked, he shouted, by some sort of green devil. We had the hardest job getting him under control. Now, in the past, Summers had spoken quite often of a green hat that he lost as a child. His father, he remembered, had punished him severely for losing it. In later life...
Mr. Glendon, this is all very interesting, but you can hardly call this dream analysis anything new.
Yes, it has been known for centuries.
Well, then I don't understand...
Mr. Carling, I know why you came to see me. Apparently, I haven't been able to keep my achievement as secret as I'd hoped.
That's right, sir. We've heard rumors.
All right, Mr. Carling. I've said that Mr. Summers' dream is very unusual. Now, would you like to see it?
You mean, see his dream?
Exactly. I'm going to show you a motion picture of Mr. Summers' dream. Photographed from the subconscious mind, exactly as he dreamed it. Attach special nerve electrodes And these electrodes pick up the current impulses of the brain. Then these impulses are transmuted back into pictures on the film of the machine. Really very similar to the method of wireless photography.
Here's Mr. Summers' dream reel, Doctor.
Oh, fine. Thanks, Eddie. The projecto tube is ready, so I'll just place the dream reel in it. And there. Hold on to your hat, Mr. Carling. You're going to see an actual dream.
Yes, yes, very well, Mr. Clauber. Three slices of lemon drops will do. He thinks I don't see him putting the pennies in his pocket when he knows they belong to me. Three slices of lemon drops it is, little boy. I'm not a little boy, Clauber, and you know it. I'm all grown up, and I don't come to your store anymore. I don't even live here anymore, and you steal pennies.
All right, get out, my little boy. Take your lemon drops and get out. Get out!
Music. I didn't know Clauber had music in his store. I don't like his music. I'll slam his door. I'll go out in the street. Now there won't be any more penny-stealing music. Well, what's that? It won't go away. It won't go away.
Summers, I am calling you.
What's that? It's not Clauber. It's green. It's a monster with great pink eyes on long stalks. It's standing in front of me. It has claws.
You're not the little boy anymore, Summers.
Oh, no, no, don't touch me with your claws.
Come with me now, Summers. You are mine. You belong to me.
No, no, no. You're touching me. Don't. Don't. No, help me. Help me, please.
Betty got to him at that moment, and the dream machine shut off.
Phew. Some dream. What effect will the discovery of this dream machine have on psychiatric research, Dr. Glendon?
Well, I've only just perfected it about 4 or 5 months ago. We've got perhaps 40 or 50 photographed dreams in our files.
40 or 50?
Yeah. However, as far as developing new techniques and treatment, maybe years before I can get them analyzed and correlated so that overall theories can be drawn from them.
As long as that.
So now you understand, Mr. Carling, why it's a little difficult for me to answer your questions.
That dream was fascinating. I've never seen anything like it. Doctor, I know I'm presuming on your time, but I'd like to see just one more. I'll have to report on these at the Government Bureau.
Well, only one more, though. I'm sorry, but I'm quite busy.
What about this one here? The purple tag. What's that for?
Well, I haven't seen that one myself yet. Purple tag means it's from the violent ward. Mr. Rudolph. Sick man. Well, we'll try it. All set.
White mice. How'd you do, Mrs. Kemp? Oh, I'm climbing a wall, and there's only two of us. There's now one. Me. Me, I'm alone. Don't take that balloon.
Much sense of that. Gibberish, I'm afraid. Rolf's a difficult case. Homicidal tendencies. Comes from a good family. He's a very successful businessman.
Name. Can you do anything for him?
Oh, I think so. There are times when he can be reached, lucid moments. And some of his dreams provide clues. Here, see?
Now, 74. That'll show him. 74, 70. You're not frightening me. I don't believe you. You can't scare me. Oh, no, no. Don't touch me. Your claws, your green claws. Oh, your green claws.
Doctor, look. On the screen. Look, there it is again. That green thing. No. Kemp, it's impossible. Two people can't possibly have the same dream.
I don't understand it, Betty. I can't understand it. I've been through all the records of both of them, Summers and Roth. There's nothing in their background that would cause them to have the same dream. Are you sure they haven't been together at some time?
I'm positive, Doctor. They haven't even met. Mr. Roth came here only a month ago, and he was placed in the violent ward immediately. He's never been out of it.
It's possible for people to have similar dreams, yes, but never to dream of the same unusual, horrible, specific subject as that green thing. Every detail was the same. The pink eyes, the claws. Makes me shudder myself. Betty, I want our dream reels. All those I haven't seen.
Oh, now you're not going to view them all. If you take your...
I don't care how long it takes. I want to see them all. I've got a funny feeling inside. And I won't be at ease until I know. Until I'm sure.
Sure of what, Dr. Glenn?
Sure that none of the other patients have had that dream. That same horrible dream of that green thing.
Dream 9, Mrs. Jordan. Shall I put the sound on?
Oh, no, not necessary. We can see it if it appears. No, nothing here.
Dream 10, Miss Farnham.
No, nothing.
I don't think we'll find anything, Doctor. It must have been a freak, a coincidence.
Keep going.
Dream 11, Mr. Craig.
Dream 21.
Nothing there either.
Dream 22. Maybe you're right, Betty. I'm beginning to think myself...
Dr. Glendon! Dr. Glendon, look! There it is!
A green thing.
Dream 42, Mr. Bradley.
Turn off the sound. Turn it off. That's it again. A green thing. Four of them, Carly. Four dreams of that monstrous green thing.
Each one from a different patient?
And each one during the past week. Darling, there's something there. Something to make even a psychiatrist feel frightened. Darling, the patients weren't having a dream. They couldn't be. They had nothing in common but the fact that they're in this sanitarium. Why, even the nature of their illnesses are different.
Doctor, aren't you getting a little mixed up yourself?
Huh?
You saw those dreams. I saw them. Betty saw them. I know it's incredible.
Listen,
but...
to have a dream means that you create that dream. You and nobody else.
You mean you think the patients didn't create those dreams? They're not their dreams?
There is such a thing as thought projection.
Mental telepathy?
Yeah.
Why should anyone want
to... Someone may have found out about the dream machine. Maybe jealousy or grudge. Or a hatred of psychiatry in general. There are many reasons. Well, what we've got to do is to find out where it's coming from. The patients must be protected.
How?
First, we've got to find out whether this telepathy is coming from inside or outside the sanitarium. Then we've got to track it down. I tell you, Carly, whoever's trying this terror by mental telepathy isn't going to get away with it. I'm not going to stand by while a lifetime's work is destroyed by a campaign of terror against my patients. Going to institute protective measures at once.
Anything yet, Doctor?
Oh, I still have the guarded screen beamed on the area directly around the main building. Don't expect to find anything so close, but I want to search every inch of the grounds.
Still feel whoever it is on the grounds.
Can't be sure of anything, except that I'm convinced that the staff is loyal, and I have a hunch that whoever is transmitting these thought waves will want to be close enough to judge the results.
Shall I bring the patients down now, Dr. Glendon?
Oh, yes, Betty. Go get them, will you, please? Is it possible that they may be able to help us? They may have felt currents emanating from a certain direction.
I think the guard screen has reached its range limit, Doctor. It's repeating itself.
All right, I'll give it wider focus. I'm going into the grounds now.
Wait, there's something. A figure on the screen.
Yeah, I see him.
Carrying a club, a stick or something. Who is it, Doctor? Can you tell?
I don't want to alarm him. I'll signal the patrol corps.
But me. That red button on the wall, isn't it?
Oh, no calling. Never mind. That is one of the patrol corps. I can see his armband.
Too bad.
Well, I'll switch the machine to the north fringe. There's another figure. We seem to be well guarded. Another member of the patrol corps. Well, let's hope the patients will be able to...
Here's Betty.
Doctor.
She's alone. Betty, where are the patients?
They're gone, Doctor.
What?
They disappeared. And a fifth patient has just begun screaming in his room, the green thing, the green thing. Accounted for, Doctor. The four that are missing would make 68. That's how many patients we have.
I checked the nurses, 8 besides Betty. They're all here. And the patrol corps have checked the rest of the staff. And no one has left the grounds except the 4 patients.
Unless somebody got in and carried them off.
No. No jetmobiles and no jet ships have been in the vicinity between the time the patients were last reported and now. The patrol corps will vouch for that.
There's the village.
Linfield. Oh, it's the only village for 100 miles, but it's a backwoods country village, a quaint place, never kept up to the times. Now, I doubt that they have any jetmobiles in Linfield, much less jet ships.
You can arrange for transportation there, can't you?
The inn? Why, that's where they go. Why didn't I think of that before? It's the center of the village, the gossip spot. If the patients entered town at all, news of them would spread to the inn. Better, you take charge here. Carling and I are going to Linfield.
How long will you be gone, Doctor?
Until we find them.
They're no longer alive.
Sorry, I can't help you none, Doctor. I ain't seen no strangers, spoke to no strangers, you're heard of no strangers.
Well, how about transportation, jetmobiles or jet ships?
Ain't put in any calls for jetmobile service nigh on to 2 months. Not since Miss Jennings busted her leg and we had to send her to the hospital in the city.
Oh.
Jet ships? Why, last time one of them flaming monsters landed here, we nearly had a riot in Linfield. Then fools all thought was invasion from Mars.
Just ran a wild goose chase, Doctor.
Yeah, so it seems. Well, thanks anyhow, Mr. Barker. You've been very helpful.
Of course, he says. The blasted idiot believes in horror. I do.
Everyone knows there's ghosts everywhere.
Idiot, there's no such thing as gold.
There are ghosts. There are ghosts in every village and town.
Quiet down, you boys. You'll be getting my inn a bad reputation off.
Hey, there's the doctor. Dr. Glendon talking to Mr. Barker. I put it up to him now. What'd you say, Doc? There's no such thing as haunts, ghosts, either now. Hey, you tell my ignorant friend.
I wasn't listening very carefully. But if it's ghosts you're talking about, well, there's never been any scientific evidence that they exist.
Haunts don't exist. That's what you're trying to say, ain't it, Doc?
That's right. Oh, come on, Carling. Let's get out of here.
Hey, there ain't no ghosts. This Doc's an educated man. He knows. Yeah. Then suppose you tell me what that green thing was floating around down near the cave. And we ain't the only one who's seen it. Right, boys?
A green thing? Where? What are these caves?
Right down to river. Why, Doc? You ain't going there. It's nighttime now.
Carling, will you risk it? I've got my ray gun.
But Doc, you're crazy. I'm telling you, there's a haunt. Why, there ain't a man in this whole village go with you tonight.
Well, if it's only a ghost, you needn't worry. But if we're not out of those caves by dawn, you better come for us. It won't be a ghost that's holding us. This must be the right cave, Carling. It's the only one with the brush trampled down in front of it.
Here is a tomb in here.
Shh, quiet. I don't hear anything.
Well, they just don't want to be taken by surprise. Have to be as quiet as possible. All right, come on. Hey, what's that? Carling, where are you? Carling, are you all right?
Oh, it's coming for me. The green thing. It's blind. It's terrible.
No, there's nothing there. You're on the floor of the cave, but there's no one near you. Nothing.
snap out of it, darling.
It's only a dream. Only a dream.
I
mean... I feel dizzy. Tired. What's the matter with me? I'm falling asleep. No, I won't. I won't hurt myself.
Dr. Glendon. Dr. Glendon. I am calling you. You must come with me.
No. No, I won't. I'll fight you. I'll fight you.
Come with me, Dr. Glendon. I control you now.
No, of course. No, no, no. It's just a dream. I know it's a dream. I'm going to wake up. I'm going to wake up. I'm going to wake up.
Oh, I did it. I'm awake. I conquered the green thing.
Did you conquer me, Dr. Glendon?
I can't be. Standing over me, the pink eyes and long stalks, the claws, the green thing.
Right in here, Dr. Glendon, into this rough chamber. And you, Mr. Carling, don't worry. You won't fall. My will is controlling you.
My patience. Over there in the corner. Ralph, Bradley, Summers, gone. Now, what have you done to him? Summers, are you all right? Bradley. Bradley, this is Dr. Glendon, your doctor. What's the matter with him? Gardner. Bradley!
Nothing is the matter with them. They just don't understand you anymore. They are attuned only to Venusian thought wave.
Venusians? You're from the planet Venus?
That is right. For a long time, we have been observing your Earth, your resources, and your remarkable technology. But we did not know how to conquer you, for we of Venus have no strength or physical dexterity, only mental power.
You shouldn't have told me that. You're going to beat that horrible body of yours to a pulpy green mess.
You hit only air, didn't you? I'm growing tired of this game. Stop. I will that your arms obey me and not you.
I can't move them. Carling, help me!
Do not be foolish again, and I will return their motion.
Hypnotize my patients the same way, didn't you? Are those dreams...
A little more complicated than what you earthlings call hypnosis. But it is mind control. I have come to Earth to prove to my planet that this is the way to conquer your Earth. We will control the minds of its inhabitants and thereby... control their strength, their physical dexterity. I began on your patients first because their minds are more easily controlled.
What do you want of
their bodies? They can perform physical acts that I cannot. With their bodies, we Venusians can continue our investigation of your planet at close range. And we can also study the structure of the Earthling when I bring them back with me.
Bring them back?
to Venus?
Do not worry, my dear doctor. I shall not separate them from you. I will also take you and your companion with me to Venus as rare prizes. Earthling, bind these two men.
No. No, don't do it. I'm your friend, your doctor. No, let me go. You shot the monster.
Forget about me. Maybe he didn't know the Earthlings had weapons too, like ray guns.
Well, why doesn't he fall? He's still standing.
Did you really think you could hurt me with that? Your death rays have no effect on my body. Drop your weapon. Find the men.
Now shoot them.
I'll kill you, please.
You cannot. But if you could, I would not care. There are millions more to choose from. You can kill yourselves, too. You are replaceable, except to yourselves. You are trapped. Your only escape is death.
Carlos, they're crumbling. The explosion of your ray gun, Carlin. You've loosened the rocks. It's a cave-in. We'll be buried alive. The corridor, quick. Clear the corridor. Grab the patients before the green thing can close us again. They can follow us. It's our only chance.
There's the mouth of the cave.
Hurry, Doctor. It's locked. The rocks have fallen here, too.
There's one big one just at the mouth. If you move that one, I think we can make it. All right, help me, Doctor.
I'll get the patients, too.
All right, come on, then.
Here. Pull. Pull.
Move it. Move it. We can squeeze through now. You go first, Doctor. Pull the patients after you.
All right. All right, I'm out. Now, Rolf, come on. That's it. All right, Bradley, you next. Come on. That's the way. All right, you, Summers.
All right, Doctor, not quick.
You, all right. That's it. All right, now you, Carlin.
I can make it.
Oh, good. Help me. Earthlings. I cannot escape.
He can't squeeze through. He has no physical strength.
Earthlings. Earthlings, come to me.
They're going to him. Still has power. Come on, Colin, quick. Before the release, and help me shove this rock over the opening. Come on, quick. There we go. Thank goodness. Hey, what's that? Look out, step back!
It collapsed. The entire cave fell in.
We were just in time.
Yes, Carling. In time to save Earth from the horror of the green things.
Pretty bad, wasn't it? But that's okay. You know, you can enjoy these things for what they are. I take my science fiction pretty seriously. I grew up reading the stuff and loved the stuff. In fact, when I was younger, I was embarrassed by all of these movies in the 50s. Movies like Teenagers from Outer Space, Fire Maidens from Outer Space, Invasion of the Saucer Men. Embarrassed by them, but I kind of enjoyed them. They were a guilty pleasure. It just annoyed me that people would see those and think that that's what science fiction was. It wasn't, you know, but you had to read the books or the magazines to know what science fiction was. mostly. Cinematic science fiction was just terrible. And for that matter, so was radio science fiction, I guess. I was a little young in 1950 to be paying much attention to that. It would be pretty soon, I mean, I think within a month of the time that this show started in 1950, that Dimension X would start. And Dimension X was a much more serious attempt at science fiction. Although, beyond 2000, this show is credited with being the first adult science fiction, and not all of it is quite as terrible as that last thing. I just didn't like people thinking that science fiction was all about bug-eyed monsters when there were authors out there like Robert Heinlein, although his Destination Moon was made into a movie in the 50s, and it was a fairly good movie. There were some pretty good movies out of the 50s. I mean, The Blob was a pretty good monster movie. And there was This Island Earth, and The Day the Earth Stood Still. There was also Forbidden Planet. But those were shiny examples in a pretty dreary landscape. And now we come to our final show for the night. This is an episode of Escape from November 3rd, 1943, entitled Devil in the Summer House.
Suspense. Suspect, suspectant, suspend. Ah, here we are. Suspense. The condition of mental uncertainty, usually accompanied by apprehension or anxiety. Fear of something which is about to occur, as do not keep me any longer in suspense. For our story of suspense tonight, we invite you to enjoy The Devil in the Summer House by John Dixon Carr. Somewhere along the Hudson, perhaps not far from Tarrytown, there is a modest house in its own grounds. Behind it, in a spacious garden, stands a summer house of evil memory. More than 25 years ago, a man shot himself, or at least died, in that summer house. They found Major Kenyon with a scorched bullet hole in his head and the weapon beside him. But we are in the present now. The latticed summer house has grown heavy with vines, and only the other evening, two men came into that garden at twilight, over the shaggy grass, as a storm was brewing along the Hudson. Two men, the lawyer from New York.
Who's there?
And Captain Burke of the Homicide Squad.
Easy, my friend, easy. I was just going to ask you the same thing.
My name is Parker. I'm an attorney. You're not Captain Burke.
Yeah, the very same and no other. I thought I recognized you, Mr. Parker. Must be something important to bring you so far from New York at this time of night.
I was in Tarrytown anyway. I thought there'd be a housekeeper here. But I don't see any lights.
You've got business here?
Yes, in a way. Have you?
I don't know. I'll tell you better after you tell me what brought you to a place that no one has lived in for 10 years.
Tell me, Captain. Did you ever get an anonymous letter from a dead man? Did you?
No, I can't say I did. The letter's anonymous. How do you know the man's dead?
Because they're all dead. Every last one of them. Dead and under the ground, where they can't be hurt any longer. Look. There's the summer house where Jerry Kenyon used to work. There are the windows of the library and the dining room. Looking for it. Confound this lightning.
Makes the windows blaze, don't it?
Jerry Kenyon hadn't a care in the world. Yet he shot himself. I'll show you the letter.
Now, look, Mr. Parker, I couldn't read anything in this light. But if we can get inside the house...
Certainly
now...
we can get into the house. I was the family attorney. I've got the keys. Why should a dead person send me a letter?
Working, eh? But you got a flashlight, I see. Came here prepared for anything, eh?
This is the library. There were always candles on the mantel. Yes, there they are. Have you a match, Captain?
Yes, I'll light them.
That's better. Same old heavy furniture. Same old thick carpet, same old globe map.
Now, Mr. Parker, this letter that you were talking about.
Yeah. Read it.
Hey, wait a minute. This thing is dated November 2nd, 1918.
That's right, and be careful of that paper. You see how old it is? But it was mailed yesterday.
From where?
I don't remember. I didn't keep the envelope. Read it.
Dear Joe.
In case you didn't know it, I'm Joe.
Dear Joe, if you want to know how Major Kenyon really died...
But we know how he died. It was suicide.
Are you sure it was? Whoever wrote this letter doesn't seem to think so. If you want to know how Major Kenyon really died, look in the third drawer of the desk in the library. Press hard at the back of the drawer, yours very truly. That's not signed.
That's right.
Are you sure you don't know who wrote that letter?
This is the first time I've been back in this room, Captain. It was almost home to me once. There's the chair where Isabel sat on the afternoon it happened. Isabel was Jerry Kenyon's wife, beautiful woman. There's the door that the maid let me in by that afternoon. You know, Captain, seems to me they're all here tonight.
Who?
We stand beneath the sounding rafter, and the walls around us are bare as they echo our peals of laughter. It seems that the dead are there.
Yet we stand to our glasses steady.
You know it?
I was in my school reader. How does the rest of it go?
Yet we stand to our glasses steady and drink to our comrade lies. Here's a glass to the dead already. Hurrah for the next that dies. Excuse me, Captain. I don't know what's come over me talking that way. I was very fond of these people.
Are you going to look in the desk drawer?
This is a lot of nonsense.
Then why are you here, Mr. Parker?
Jerry Kenyon was always a happy man. At least that's what I always thought. Big, boisterous fellow.
Yeah?
He had a good position with Vitatone. You know, the phonograph company.
Yeah, sure, I know.
But he'd just been made a major in the army. 1917. There was a war on then, too, if you remember.
I remember. To make the world safe for democracy.
Old days. Old heartaches. Old memories. I remember that blazing hot day in August. And all the windows were up. I remember this room. And Isabel, that was Jerry's wife, sitting in that chair, knitting. I remember...
Oh, yes, Kitty. What is it?
There's a man to see you, Miss Kenyon. He says his name's Parker.
Yes, I'm expecting him. Show him in, please.
All right, ma'am. So I take your knitting in your knitting bag?
Why should you take my knitting?
I don't know, Miss Kenyon. I just wondered. You can come in now.
Thank you.
Hello, Joe.
Hello, Isabel. You sent for me?
Joe, I must apologize for Kitty. Servants are getting to be a problem nowadays.
She looks pretty enough to get along.
Oh, Kitty's got large ideas. She wants to go on the stage, if you please, and do imitations, like Miss Draper. She only knew how hard it was acting all your life.
Isabel, you've been crying.
I have not. At least...
Is that why you sent for me?
I've missed you. You haven't been here in over a week, Joe.
I had an idea Jerry was getting a little tired of having me around this house.
Oh, no, Joe. Why, Jerry...
Yes, what about Jerry?
I wish I knew, Joe. That's why I wanted you here.
Where is he, by the way? I want to say goodbye to him before he leaves.
He's probably out in the summer house where he works with all those papers. He's got a lot of work to catch up with. He's going overseas tomorrow.
Yes, I know.
He's out there. He's been out there all day. His last day here. I've been alone.
That sounded like a shot.
Yes, it was a shot, Jerry.
No, it doesn't seem to worry you.
It's only Paul. Jerry's brother, Paul.
Oh, but you'd gotten him off your hands for good.
Jerry asked him out. He got here 2 nights ago.
That doesn't make it any easier for you, does it?
Oh, I don't mind. Jerry's fixed him up with a pistol range in the cellar. Paul's a terribly bad shot. Not like the rest of us. You don't seem to like it, Joe. Shall I have Kitty go down and tell
him? No, it's terrible. As long as he keeps away.
Poor Joe.
But, about Jerry, who is it this time?
Joe, Jerry's been home 5 days on leave from camp. Well, never mind what camp. But he spent 4 evenings of those 5 with that Fisk woman.
Diane Fisk? The redhead with all the money?
Oh, she got money?
Well.
She must have some attraction then. Please understand me, Joe. It's not that I'm jealous any longer. It's just
no,
that...
No, of course not.
Jerry goes his way and I go mine. I may not be without admirers myself if it comes to that.
You've no idea how true that is, Isabel.
No, I was thinking about Jerry. He may not always be lucky. He may meet some girl who's not as broad-minded as I am. And then when he gives her the go-by... Paul must be getting really furious down in that cell. He's not hitting anything.
He must be using a lot of ammunition.
Now, your trouble, Joe, is that you're too much of a gentleman. And if you really want to see Jerry, there he is now.
Where?
Just standing in the door of the summer house. Look out the window.
And finally, bright out there.
Doesn't he look noble in his new uniform? Sam Brown belt and revolver and everything. Look how he turns around and waves his cap at us. Like a real soldier.
Real soldiers don't exactly wave their caps, do they?
He does. Jerry? Jerry?
Hello there.
Jerry, Joe Parker's here.
Who?
Joe Parker. He wants to see you. Into the summer house again. Not a care in the world, Henry.
Now, listen, Isabel, you've got to slow down. You'll be crying again in a minute. Come on over here and sit down.
Light hurts my eyes, that's all.
Well, then we'll just pull these blinds. We'll still be able to see. There, how's that?
It's better, thanks.
Now, can I get you anything?
Oh, no. You heard the great white chief's orders. I'm to get you something. What do you have, Joe? A highball?
Don't bother with that.
Oh, it's no bother. Everything's out in the dining room here. The ice man didn't deliver today of all days, so I'm afraid I can't give you any ice. I read in the paper yesterday that we're likely to have automatic ice boxes any day now. Things that freeze ice by electricity or something. Do you believe that, Joe?
I doubt it. Listen, Isabel.
Here you are. Not cold at all. It's the best I could do.
Thanks very much. What I wanted to say was, couldn't you get that brother of yours to give up practicing now? Hasn't he done his good deed for the day?
Yes, maybe he has. I'll ring for Kitty.
You don't have to call me, Miss Canyon. I'm here.
Oh, yes, Kitty. What is it?
It's only to tell you there's another visitor. This time it's a woman.
Lady Kitty. Call her a lady, please.
Well, maybe. She says her name's Diane Fisk.
Diane Fisk? That's Jerry.
Kitty, tell the lady I'm not in.
Lady. She's a fine lady. I do want her truth, my dear. I do want her truth. Anyway, it's too late, Miss Kenyon. She's coming down the hall now.
My dear Mrs. Kenyon.
How do you do, Diane? This is a friend of ours, Miss Fisk. Miss Parker.
Now, I don't want to intrude, really. I don't. I wouldn't have intruded for worlds, especially on a day like this. Isn't it awful? But your husband simply insisted, my dear Mrs. Kenyon. He simply wouldn't take no for an answer.
I'm sure he wouldn't.
Do you know what he's brought from his office as a surprise?
No.
A phonograph recording machine. He's going to let us use it.
So that we can all hear ourselves talk twice. How nice. Kenny's name. Can't somebody stop that firing?
Don't fly off the handle. Take it easy.
Kitty.
Yes, ma'am.
Would you please go down the cellar and tell Mr. Kenyon's brother he's driving us all crazy. Tell him to stop.
Yes, ma'am.
My dear Mrs. Kenyon, I do hope I haven't offended you in any way. I know I'm a silly little chatterbox. They say people who have red hair often are. Because at your age, you must find the heat very trying.
Don't you think we'd all better sit down?
I
was very much interested in what Miss Fisk said about our phonograph recording machine. Mrs. Kenyon was just talking about a machine to make ice.
Yes. Isn't science wonderful? But I do think it was me to Major Kenyon to invite me out here and then go and fall asleep in the summer house.
Did you say fall asleep?
Yes, of course.
How did you know?
Well, I came up the back way and I saw him in the summer house with his head forward on the table, taking a nice little snooze.
That's very queer.
Of course, you couldn't see much except in the bright light of the door, but I think I saw him there. I didn't disturb him, naturally.
But I think I'd better disturb him.
Oh, now, please, don't trouble on my account.
The fact is, my dear, I don't altogether trust myself in this room. A woman of my age has to conserve her strength, you know. So if you'll just excuse me.
Well, of course, if you... Dear, I just can't think what I'm always saying, because I have the best intentions in the world, Mr. Barker.
Parker.
Yes, Parker, but I do somehow manage to offend people being so dependent and everything. Except the men, of course. I couldn't offend you, Mr. Barker, a Parker. Now, could I?
Madam, I'm not sure.
Well, of course, the person I really came to see was Paul, Mr. Kenyon's brother. He's a little young, of course, but he's joining up next month, and I think we should all do our bit, don't you? He has such a pleasant personality. I think he likes me. Why, if he walked in at that door this minute...
Now, how am I ever going to get any place? Someone's always interrupting my revolver practice just when I'm getting to the point where I can... How?
Why, Paul...
Good Lord, are you here again?
You're a very untidy object, Paul.
Well, that's pretty untidy in this cellar. And dirty. I've got cockroaches on me, so keep away.
Did you have a good day shooting?
Swell. One of the best.
Hit the target?
On the only shot that mattered, I hit the target dead center. That sounded like Isabel.
I think it was Isabel.
Why have you got those blinds down? Get them up. What is it? What's wrong with you? What are you looking at through that window?
That was 25 years ago, Captain Burke. We found Jerry Kenyon lying across the table in the summer house. He'd shot himself through the head with his own revolver from the holster. It was lying on the floor beside him.
Shadows, I see.
When Isabel found him, he'd been dead about half an hour.
The doctors proved that, did they?
Yes, that shot had been fired against his head. The front of his uniform cap was powder-burned where the bullet entered.
There's no doubt about that.
None at all. We never noticed the real shot because...
Because that young lad was shooting off guns like a maniac in the cellar.
Precisely. Now they're all dead. By accident, illness, they're all gone. Isabel Kenyon died less than a year afterwards. I think she died just because she was so fond of Jerry. I suppose you've guessed my little secret.
Oh, I think I can sort of read between the lines. You were in love with Isabel Kenyon, weren't you?
Yes.
Well, these things happen.
I never let her see it, you understand?
Women know, pretty generally.
So, they're gone, the youngest of them. And I'm left alone with old tunes, old ghosts, wondering why the fellow ever killed himself. Why? Why? And this morning, out of a clear sky, I get a letter saying, if you want to know how Major Kenyon really died, look in the third drawer of the desk in the library. But I tell you, we know how he died.
Well, aren't you going to do it?
Naturally. I've got a key somewhere here that fits the drawer.
Now, listen, Mr. Parker. In my father's country, in Ireland, they got a saying that when a man's going to commit suicide...
I thought of doing that, too. Once.
Then the devil comes in and takes him by the hand and talks to him. They say you can see the devil as plain as I see you just before you pull the trigger.
The devil must have been in the summer house that afternoon.
Oh, no, he wasn't.
What do you mean?
Major Kenyon didn't kill himself. He was murdered.
My dear Captain Burke, the police covered all that at the time. Everybody had an alibi.
They did they?
Well, think of what I've told you. Isabel and I were together all the time. Paul, her brother, was shooting off guns in the cellar.
Yes.
Diane Fisk?
Yeah, what about her?
Her chauffeur who drove her there swore he saw her walk straight up to the place. She passed the summer house but didn't stop there.
Well, that checks.
Even Kitty the maid could prove she'd never stirred out of the house. Until just a minute or so before Isabel went herself.
Oh, and why did the maid have to leave the house at all?
She was taking Jerry the black coffee he drank every afternoon. He'd already been dead half an hour then.
And that, my dear Captain, disposes of everybody.
Well, now listen, Mr. Parker. You're a good guy, and I'm not going to hold out on you any longer. You see, I say Major Kenyon was murdered because I know he was murdered.
By an outsider?
By one of the people in the house.
That's impossible.
Is it? Well, why don't you open that desk drawer and see? What time is it?
It's 7:45.
7:45? And I haven't got much time.
For what?
Holy St. Patrick, will you open that drawer?
If it's waited 25 years, my friend, it can wait a minute more. I've got the key somewhere in this bunch of keys. Everything the same. Paul never altered what he inherited. Same old desk, same old phonograph. Same old... I think this is the key.
Yeah.
It opens. There's nothing here except one or two old newspapers. Everything very dirty.
The letter says to press hard at the back. Now, have you tried that?
Doesn't seem to. Yes, by George, it does work.
Well?
There seems to be a movable back on a hinge.
Well, what's inside?
Some sort of flat brown paper parcel sealed with wax. And about as dirty as it can get.
Open it, man. Open it.
I'm going to. It's a phonograph record. There's a plain white label. Something on it written in pencil. I don't see too well nowadays without my glasses.
Here, give it to me. I'll read it to you.
Go on.
A record of how I killed Jerry Kenyon. Say, don't you get it, Mr. Parker? This is the real goods. The murderer is going to tell us his own story 25 years later.
Be careful. Whatever you do, don't drop it.
You seem to be interested enough now.
I don't say I'm not interested. I say I can't believe it.
You know, when you were talking about the dead coming back and that kind of thing, you sure started giving me goose pimples. But that's just what it is, a dead person. Now, there's the phonograph. Put that record on. Let's hear what the ghost says.
Any of them could have made the record, of course. The apparatus was all here.
Don't just stand there by the phonograph. Want to work?
Yes, it works.
Is it wound up?
Yes, it's wound up. Here goes.
Now, look, Mr. Parker. Whose voice do you think it's going to be?
I don't know.
Now, I want to warn you. The voice you're going to hear from there...
Please. Be quiet. Listen. I've started it up. Well? Speak up. Who killed Jerry Kenyon?
I killed him, Joe, dear.
Once about.
I'm sorry about it, Joe, but I had to have you for an alibi. And you were so terribly easy to fool.
It's only a phonograph record, man. Don't look at it as if it was alive.
You said you and I were always together, Joe. But that wasn't quite true. I left you to go into the dining room and mix a highball, remember?
Yes.
And I was carrying my big knitting bag. Remember that, too? And there was something else in it besides knitting. I'm an awfully good revolver shot, Joe. I told you we were all good except Paul. And the back windows of the dining room face the same way as the back windows of the library.
Thank you, Isabel. Thank you.
Jerry was in the summer house. I made a sign to him from the window, and he came to the door there. In bright sunlight, 50 feet away.
True again, Isabel.
Don't you know what August heat is in a wooden summer house? Didn't anybody see that no man would be wearing a cap inside on a day like that? Jerry had taken his cap off before he went into the summer house. We saw him do it. He was bareheaded when he came to the door. So I lifted the revolver and shot him through the head. Then I dropped the gun back in my knitting bag. And went back into the library with your drink.
Isabel.
Don't talk back to the thing, man. You'll drive me screwy.
There was something else in my knitting bag, too. I had to use it. It was a duplicate of Jerry's army cap, with a powder-burned hole already fired through it in the place I wanted.
Very clever of you, Isabel. So I've been the goat for 25 years.
I waited for some time, and then slipped out to find the body. I fitted the new cap over Jerry's head, in place where it ought to go. I put the old cap in my knitting bag. I took his revolver out of the holster and kept it. The gun that I used, I dropped on the floor beside him. So I proved it was suicide. You see?
You proved it to me.
Joe. So Joe, listen. I'm very sick. They tell me I'm going to die.
You are dead.
Joe, I'm afraid. I'm going out in the dark, and I don't know what's there.
Don't go away, Isabel. Come
Joe.
Just for a
minute. Okay, I've had just about enough of this.
Joe, I want you to tell everybody about it. I want you to tell them how a poor, crazy woman couldn't stand that man any longer, and how...
It's cut off, and it's going to stay cut off.
Thank you. I've heard about enough, too. But you can't arrest her now, my friend. You can't arrest her now.
After hearing that, I'm not going to arrest anybody.
Tell me, Captain. Did you know what was on the record?
No. That's why I had to hear it. I knew about it, but I wasn't sure what it had to say. But so help me, I never guessed how hard it would hit you. Man, don't you get it even yet?
Yes, I get it.
Oh, no, you don't. You don't see anything. That was how the fake suicide was managed, yes. That's just how it was all done, bar one or two little things. Only...
Only what?
Only it wasn't Isabel Kenyon who committed the murder.
Did I hear you correctly?
You did?
This is another one of your little jokes, I imagine. Can't you let me alone? Have you some kind of personal spite against me? What did I
have
to do?
You're going to hear the real truth now if I have to hold you down in that chair. I know Mrs. Kenyon didn't kill her husband because I've just come from talking to the real murderer up the river.
But they're all dead.
Oh, no, they're not. And I haven't got much time either. That clock's just going to strike 8.
What's the time got to do with it?
Good deal if you'll follow me. Mrs. Kenyon died less than a year after her husband, didn't she?
Yes.
But it wasn't Mrs. Kenyon's voice you just heard in that record.
What?
I'm telling you, the real murderer hated her. Hated her like poison and wanted her blamed for the crime. When Mrs. Kenyon died, the real murderer wrote a letter.
Well?
But she never mailed that letter. She made a lying record of Isabel Kenyon's voice as evidence. Now you figure it out for yourself. Who was pretty enough to take Major Kenyon's eye and strike back like fury when she got thrown over? Who wanted to go on the stage and do impersonations?
Kitty, the maid.
Ah, you're talking sense.
She shot Jerry from the dining room window.
When she couldn't borrow Mrs. Kenyon's knitting bag, she went out to the summer house with a gun and the fake cap wrapped in a napkin and a coffee tray.
She did go out, I remember.
Actually, she got there before Mrs. Kenyon did. But the summer house was dark inside and Mrs. Kenyon never noticed her. The next day, Kitty wrote that letter, but she couldn't bring herself to send it. So she kept that letter till the day before yesterday. Then one of the boys at Sing Sing...
Wait a minute.
Thinking he was doing her a kind action, put a stamp on it and mailed it.
Did you say Sing Sing?
Yes. They're electrocuting her tonight for the murder of an Italian down at Collier's Hook. I found out about the record, all right. But the one thing I wasn't sure of was that she had done the job alone. Now, frankly, the way you act it, I thought that you might have been in on it, too. Well, that's why I had to hear it through. And it was anything but a joke. And now, here it goes to blazes forever. Clock. Ah, she's dead.
I did want to take a moment here to remind you that you can write me at nighttransmissions@gmail.com. Now, that's just one word, night transmissions. There's no space between the night and the transmissions. Once again, it's nighttransmissions@gmail.com. I'd like to hear from you. I'd like to know if anybody's listening, actually. This is Gary Clinton.
Thank you.